It's happy city. Happy city.
It's 8:30 Philadelphia time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike challenges you to match your erudition against the combined brains of four almost know-it-alls. You provide the questions and our experts try to answer them. Remember, for every question used, Lucky Strike will give you not only $10 in war stamps, but a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If your question is muffed, you get the Junior Britannica, plus a $50 war bond, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information, Please. And now, right up a lucky strike, as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, although our program proceeds in its usual spontaneous manner, this is something of a special occasion. We are broadcasting from the stage of the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. Philadelphia marks stop number 2 in our barnstorming tour, conceived by the producer of Information, Please, Mr. Dan Golenthal. This tour is Mr. Golenthal's contribution to the Treasury Department's bond drive. Each seat in this tremendous hall represents a bond purchase of from $50 to $5,000, making a grand, and we mean grand, total of $3,337,183. Which is considerable dough, even in Mr. Morgenthau's language. Now, tonight, on this special occasion, we have as our board of experts Oscar Levant, Franklin P. Adams, John Curran, whose new column appears in the New York Sun and other papers, and as our guest, the young congressional representative from California, fresh from his tank destroyer unit where he served as a second lieutenant, the Honorable Will Rogers, Jr. Now, appropriately enough, our first question comes from an author who will probably owe his immortality to Philadelphia, Mr. Christopher Morley, the author of Kitty Foyle. And Mr. Morley, who hails from New York City, a secondary town, of course, has worked out a question about Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a city, says Mr. Morley, known for its warmth and affection. And that's true. What Philadelphian of the past or present is known by the affectionate name of Betsy? Betsy, Mr. Curran.
Betsy Ross.
Betsy Ross.
Who sold the first American flag.
Quite right. And what was... Pardon?
There are... I keep reading stories that she didn't do the flag. I don't know.
Well, this is not the time to bring that up, Mr. You choose stop number 3 to tell us that. Betsy Ross is popularly supposed to have created, sewn together the first American flag. Mr. Curran, what was her full name? This is Philadelphia, you know, and you better know it.
Elizabeth.
Yes. That isn't full enough.
I don't know.
Elizabeth Griscom Ross. Now, how about what Philadelphian is known as Connie? Connie.
Cornelius McGillicuddy.
Yes, Cornelius McGillicuddy or Connie Mack. Quite right.
He's not from Philadelphia. He's been living here 70 years, but he's not from Philadelphia.
Well, he's made a living here of a sort, hasn't he?
Temporarily speaking.
And finally, what Philadelphian is known as Rosie? R-O-S-Y. Very famous Philadelphian.
Rosie?
Rosie, a great citizen of this town, known as Rosie.
Rosenblum? Rosenbaum?
No. You're near, though. It's the famous bibliophile and book collector.
Oh, who is that? I still don't know. Rosen...
Yeah?
Rosen...
That's right.
Rosenbach.
Attaboy, yeah. A.S.W. Rosenbach, a name well known to everybody who loves books.
To anybody who has more than $50,000.
That gives us 2 out of 3. And while we're on the subject of Philadelphia, I'd like to get one thing settled that's always worried me. Mr. Morley, in his book, talks of the main line a good deal, huh? How far does the main line run, socially speaking?
Do the Trenton.
Mr. I mean, Mr.?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe around Haverford or Chestnut Hill around there.
You're just guessing. If it weren't for the fact that I have the answer on the card, I wouldn't know. Mr. Levant?
As far as Ginger Rogers was concerned, it ran to New York. She ran to New York.
That was her main line, but the actual, I understand, is from Philadelphia to Paoli. Would that be about right? Actually, of course, the main line on the railroad goes from Philadelphia to Chicago, but from the Philadelphian point of view, it stops at Paoli. And that sends us on to a question from Mrs. S.S. Groglode of Ohio. To what outfit would an American soldier belong if you heard him talking about these things? Suppose you heard him say, Geronimo, what outfit would he belong to? Mr. Rogers.
I believe he'd belong to the parachute battalion.
That's quite right. Do you have any idea why he would be?
Well, they're supposed to yell that, I believe, in order to keep their... say something so that the head can be clear as they fall through the air.
Yes.
And when they land.
Yes, it's a tradition, not very old, to call Geronimo as a signal that they're about to jump.
It's ecstasy, the way I heard it on the radio.
It's what?
It's a con... Well, forget it.
All right. Now, suppose you heard an American soldier say, bazooka. What would he be talking about? Bazooka. Mr. Rogers again.
He'd be talking about a very secret weapon.
Tell us all about it.
It's a swell weapon, I can assure you.
Yeah.
And,
Well, then what outfit is it used?
Well, we use it, and the tank destroyers have used it.
Yes.
But I don't know who would use it. I don't know what you have on your car.
Well, I have tank destroyers on my car. Yeah, so you'd be a member of a tank destruction outfit. Was that your own job, Mr. Rogers, before you demoted yourself?
We used all weapons. That's a very good weapon, I should like to say, and may be quite a surprise.
Well, you talk about it's a secret weapon.
I hope it'll be the surprise that you say it will be, Mr. Rogers. And how about this one? If an American soldier used the phrase, in the barrel, what outfit would he belong to? In the barrel. Oh, we've got 2 out of 3 on this, so you can exercise your fantasy. Mr. Kieran?
My fantasy would say he'd be on a submarine.
No. No, he'd be a member of a daylight bombing squadron. Because the term in the barrel is used to describe an accurate hit in precision bombing. The sort of stuff that our boys are trained to do in daylight bombing raids. Right in the barrel. Now, how about this one from Jane Deck of Atlanta, Georgia? This is about characters in poems who died under peculiar conditions. The first character is in a poem, and he died while giving a soldier a drink. Who was that? Mr. Curran.
That was poor, dear old Gunga Din.
Gunga Din, yeah.
I hope you like your drink, sir, he said, just before he died.
That's right. Now, what were you going to say, Mr. Adams?
Same thing.
Good, very good. And Mr. Rogers?
A point of information.
Who was the man that gave
him the drink out of a canteen?
Philip Sidney?
Philip Sidney.
Yes, but that wasn't a character in a poem. That was a real chap. Real Elizabethan. Have you learned something, Mr. Rogers?
I have.
Well, that's more than most congressmen do so early in their career. Name the character in a poem who died after delivering news of victory. He died, Mr. Levant.
Is that the marathon man?
I think he did.
He didn't live long after that run.
No, he didn't. That's right. Mr. Adams, another one?
Smiling, the boy fell dead.
Yes. And who was this boy?
I don't know.
He was Philip.
Mr. Kieran, can you help out, Mr. Adams?
Well, the name of the marathon messenger who did fall dead, according to Browning's poem, was Pheidippides, and there is no name to the young boy who flew out and took the battery smoke at the Battle of Ratisbon.
Yes, Mr. Adams is thinking of what poem?
Browning's, An Incident in the French Camp.
Yes. You see, he has no name, Adams. You'll never know who your boyfriend is. Now, how about this one? A character in a poem who died because she looked out the window. Mr. Kieran.
The Lady of Shalott.
The Lady of Shalott.
Tennyson.
Very good. Well, that gives us 3 dying characters out of 3, and that's enough for a gloomy question. How about this one from Ruth Harmon of Union City, New Jersey? Here's the situation, gentlemen. Let's say there's a news commentator in Burma. And this news commentator wants to tell his audience which of the United Nations are engaged in a battle. Now, to get by the local censor, he sings these songs into the mic. We're going to have them played. Which nations are in the fighting? In other words, the songs ought to indicate the nation that he means is engaged in the battle in Burma. Is that absolutely clear or quite unclear? Well, let's have the first. tricky one. Mr. Rogers, is that your hand?
I'll make a guess.
Yeah.
Irish?
It can't be Irish.
No.
McCree? Scotch?
No. What's the song that was played? Mr. Levant?
He guessed. Let him guess the name of the song.
I guess Mother McCree.
No, that's not Mother McCree.
Endearing Charms.
It sounds very much like Believe Me If All Those Endearing Young Charms, but that isn't right.
I know what it is.
Yes, Mr. Levant.
Is that a cowboy thing?
That's right. And what nation would be involved?
Well, you'll get smart. What time we have cowboys?
Yes, kid. That's coming right back at me.
Uh-huh.
It would, of course, be the American.
Gary Cooper would be.
That gives us one wrong. Now we have to get the next one. Let's have the next code message. Mr. Levant has two hands up.
Chinese.
What is being played?
Chinese lullaby from east as west, to play by the late Samuel Shipman.
Very good. Yes, that's a perfect answer.
Pretty strong.
And a pretty neat reply, too. Now the third and last musical code message. Mr. Rogers.
But he is an Englishman.
Very good, yes. Very good. Whose song is that, Mr. Rogers? Who wrote it?
Is it Gilbert or Sullivan's?
Ask Mr. Adams. He's right there.
Sullivan wrote the music to that song.
Thank you, Father.
Now you've exhausted Adams' information for the whole evening. All right, that gives us 2 out of 3. How about this one from Mary E. Rowell of Cumberland, Maryland? Let's see, there are 4 of you, aren't there?
I hope.
let's see if you can mention 4 colloquial terms that name foods that might be used as substitutes for meat on Meatless Tuesdays. In other words, any colloquial term using the name of any other food that might be used as a substitute for ordinary meat, Mr. Levant.
You poor fish.
Yes, personal remark to Bard on it. That's very good, however.
What's the difference between meatless days and the days you're supposed to be able to get meat, incidentally?
You mean you can get meat on Meatless Tuesday?
I don't know.
No, you can't. Poor fish is a perfectly good one, Mr. Kieran.
Let him eat crow.
Let him eat crow? Aren't you mixing it up with Marie Antoinette's Let Him Eat Cake?
No, well, let him eat crow now.
To eat crow is an old expression, sure. Mr. Adams.
A man of your kidney.
That's all right. Because Mr. Adams is quite right, because kidneys are allowed on Tuesdays.
Never alone and like it.
Oh, that's fair. Mr. Kieran?
On Meatless Tuesday, why, you can make your enemy eat his own words.
That is as bad as meat.
Yeah, that's an awful cheap gobbled oat meal.
We're turkey here.
Yeah, that's a very good one.
Lay an egg.
There we are. Mr. Rogers, what were you going to say?
I'll have your liver and your lights. Liver or your lights.
Very good. Those are both things you can eat if you wish on Meatless Tuesday. And now Mr. Rysdale, without naming any names, says that experts are likely to be rather critical people.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, I mean critical in a good sense. For example, a tobacco expert smoking a cigarette obviously does so with a full knowledge of the facts. Certainly, mildness and better taste depend upon fine tobacco. And that's worth remembering when you consider that the overwhelming preference of independent tobacco experts goes to Lucky Strike. These experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehousemen, know tobacco from A to Z. So they can't help but know the kind of tobacco that means a better smoke for you. And at auctions they attend, they obviously see who buys what tobacco. Yes, year after year, tobacco experts see Lucky Strike consistently select the riper, lighter, milder leaf. Smokers, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. So round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw. Mr. Fadiman, have I shown that Luckies have what it takes to please the critical?
Yes, Mr. Rysdale, your 60-second summary makes clear why, with men who know tobacco best, it's Luckies 2-1. And now the next question comes from a gentleman, presumably from Washington, who prefers to be unnamed, and you'll see why when I read the question to you. I assure you that we will pay out in any case, but we will not name the asker of this question. Who made each of these remarks about the government and its employees? The first remark is as follows. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a committee by the toe. If they holler, give them go. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Who said that? Mr. LeVant.
That could be in, not let me take, the I Sing.
That's right. Remember the character who did the...
Throttlebottom.
Throttlebottom is right.
The convening of the Senate.
Was it about the Senate?
Yeah.
Well, that let you out.
The Senate meets to impeach William Gaxton, who at that time was Wintergreen for president.
Very good. Yes, that gives us practically the complete plot, free of charge. Now, how about, who said this? Please can be taught practically anything that a congressman can. Mr. Rogers, do you have any idea?
I protest.
Exception. Mr. Kieran?
I thought it might be Will Rogers.
Sounds very much as if it would be, but it's Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, please can be taught practically anything that a congressman can. And,
I didn't think it was the old man.
Well, who said this? What this country needs in Congress is a man who owns his own dress suit.
That's him.
That's him. You know what I'd like to hear you say, Mr. Rogers? I'd like to hear you say that sentence your own way. But that sounds a lot like the way your father used to say it. What this country needs in Congress is a man who owns his own dress suit. Just say it for us, will you?
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, sure. Just say it. What this country needs in Congress is a man who owns his own dress suit. Well, that sounds a little bit like the old man.
No.
Not so funny.
No.
Pretty
not
good. That gives us 3 out of 3. Now, how about 2 out of 3? Now, how about this one from Corporal Technician Victor Cates of Wilson, North Carolina? In Army talk, what's the difference between these words? Among these words, you might say, furlough, pass, and leave. What's a furlough? Mr. Kieran.
Soldier goes on furlough if it's a time limit over a pass leave limit, which is a short. You go on pass downtown, you might get an overnight pass.
Well, now, furlough, that's the idea, but exactly how many days, Mr. Rogers?
3 days, I believe, is a pass.
Under 3 days or over for a furlough?
Under for a pass and over for a furlough.
That's exactly right.
Wrong?
I say, a furlough is anything over 3 days for an enlisted man.
Didn't he say that?
What else did I say?
I thought he said that.
What he means is that an officer goes on leave.
Yes, that's right.
I hope to have caught it.
Yes. If an officer goes on leave for more than 3 days, that's called leave, absence from duty for over 3 days.
What is AWOL? That's not a furlough, is it?
That would be the kind of furlough that you'd probably have to get, Mr. LeVant, if you were in the Army. Gosh, it seems such a something, you people. How about this one from Abraham Kaplan of Washington, D.C., otherwise known as our nation's capital, if you're a commentator, whose language is being characterized in these lines? And my language is plain. Whose language is being... Mr. Adams.
That's Bret Hart.
Bret Hart, the author of the line.
Bret Hart, and my language is plain. That's the heathen Chinese.
Yes, you got the right poem, all right. But whose language is characterized by that... Who says that about his own language, Mr. Kieran?
Truthful James.
Truthful James, yes. Plain language from Truthful James.
That's the title of the poem, isn't it?
That's the title.
Plain speaking from Truthful James.
Plain language from Truthful James.
Plain language, Mr. Rogers, that's right.
You are all right.
You're doing fine, Mr. Rogers. Now, how about this one? She speaks a various language. Who is the she? And she speaks a various language. I have both Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams. I'll go by alphabet. Mr. Adams. A brain you to get this wrong, Mr. Adams. See, you don't know.
To
that's a replay.
Him who in the love of nature.
Oh, yes, you got the poem all right. Mr. Kieran, who's
well,
the
well, he just named it. Nature.
Nature.
Yes, nature. Sure.
Ma nature.
Yes, ma nature. That's the one. Now, how about bad language or abuse? Whose language is characterized, Mr. Adams?
Captain Corcoran.
Who's what's he from?
He is from HMS Pinafore, or The Last Who Loved a Sailor.
Yes, very good. And how does he happen to say, use the phrase bad language or abuse? Can you give us a line or two in which that occurred?
I never use whatever the emergency.
And never use what?
I never use a big D.
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
Never?
Oh, no, never. All right. 3 out of 3, and now one from Ralph Baltzell of New York City. And this is a difficult musical question, gentlemen. Mr. Rogers, how are you on music?
Very poor.
Very poor. Well, you can stay in with Adams and Sheeran then. Each of the following symphonies is opened by a solo instrument. I want you to identify the symphony and the instrument. Let's have the first. Mr. Levant.
See the Sibelius or the old oaken bucket?
Well, I suppose you throw out the bucket and leave Sibelius. And which symphony is that? What number? Opus number what?
I think it's 7.
It's number 2, I think. Sibelius number 2. And what is the instrument? Don't look.
Oboe.
All right. Very good. Now the second of these tests. Mr. Levant again.
The piano plays there, too. That's in the Shostakovich number 1, the scherzo, right after the first movement.
That's very good, yes. Very good. And what was the instrument Mr. Levant was playing?
It was a trumpet.
Yes, you did trumpet, quite right. And now the third and last of these. Well, the rest of you boys are sure having a rest. I've got 2 hands for Mr. Levant.
That's very pathetic. That's a pathetic symphony, yeah. Tchaikovsky.
Yes.
A bassoon.
A bassoon, yes. That's 3 out of 3. And now, before we go on to the next question, here's Mr. Cross, who is willing to wager that you never thought of this as a cradle song.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that historic chant is truly a lullaby for tobacco. The riper, lighter, milder Lucky Strike leaf that's sold American at auctions all over the South actually goes to sleep for 2 to 4 years to age and mellow for your Lucky Strike. Indeed, as visitors to Richmond, Virginia may have noticed, above our great storehouses there is a big sign reading, "Quiet, please, tobacco asleep." And in Durham and Reidsville, North Carolina, in Lexington, Kentucky, and elsewhere in the tobacco country, sleep many more hundreds of millions of pounds of fine Lucky Strike tobacco. Ladies and gentlemen, these facts help to illustrate how important fine tobacco is to your smoking enjoyment. Before you light your first Lucky Strike, just stop and think that it took 2 to 4 years for that Lucky to be born. Then light up your Lucky Strike, so round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw, and enjoy to the full the mildness and mellowness of fine tobacco, carefully selected, patiently aged, perfectly blended.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. And now a question from R.J. McBride of Washington, D.C. What nations successfully used these tactics in fighting against tanks? What one used airplanes equipped with anti-tank cannon? Mr. Rogers.
Everyone knows that. The Russians.
The Russians. And what were those planes called?
Stormovik.
Stormovik, yes. You have a very fine Russian accent. You set out in California.
I like my English accent.
That's quite right. Now, which nation used buried anti-tank guns? Mr. Levant.
Germany, in their first retreat from Russia, they dug them as a defense, you know, instead of...
Germany is right. Whether they used it against the Russians,
that's
I don't
the first
know.
First time they retreated, they must have.
Is that right, Mr. Rogers? You seem to know about that.
Probably right.
Well, I also am informed that the Germans used them against the British in Libya in the spring of 1942, but they might have used it in Russia.
So
at
they
same
did.
Time. All right. Now, how about a nation that used self-propelled artillery in fighting tanks?
Oh, no.
Mr. Curran.
We're using them right now.
Yes, we are, and before us, who did? Mr. Rogers?
Well, the Germans used them.
They did use self-propelled artillery? I hate to think that, but we have the edge on them there.
What about the Italians in those Toronto and the Mediterranean? That's not artillery, that's the Navy.
I know, but it's generally considered American.
Generally considered American, but I understand the British used them in their breakthrough at El Alamein. Great victory of some time ago.
Oh, which great deal that was our own, I believe.
Our own self-propelled artillery? Well, it's nice to know that. And how about this one from Robert Delson of New York? Identify these famous performers. The first was a pianist who talked to himself in public. Mr. Levant?
Vladimir de Pachman. A cutie, too. He was cute.
You haven't learned anything from him, Mr.
Very Levant? Much. I talk about him and to myself all the time.
Vladimir de Pachman, yes. How about a conductor who lectured his audience on their lack of taste? Mr. Adams.
That might be L. Stokowski.
Yeah. Where did this happen, Mr. Adams?
I think it happened in this here hall.
Yeah. It was the same hall, but naturally an entirely different audience. Mr. Levant?
Was that the performance of the Schoenberg Violin Concerto?
Yes. By the way, is it good?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Schoenberg's a great composer. That's good.
Well, you're...
I'm getting Philadelphia hostile.
Well, they're very nice about that sort of thing. They'll forget what you said in no time. How about this?
I don't want them to forget. I want them to remember.
And listen to Schoenberg. That's too much all at one time. Identify this performer. He appeared on the stage with his instrument, but he never played it. Mr. Levant.
Last year there was a radio gag, and somebody appeared at Odeon Hall. A. Odeon Hall. No, Tom Hall. Odeon Hall's been dead for years.
Hasn't it, though?
It was a gag. I wouldn't take it or... What's the name of that program?
I don't know.
Shut up or put up or whatever it is.
Take it or leave it?
I don't know. And it was a gag. Couldn't play at all.
Well, also, there's another performer, more famous, Joe Cook. He used to tell the story about the four Hawaiians. Had a mandolin in his hand, and he never did play.
Ukulele,
something of the sort. How about this one from F.I. Whiteman of New Haven? On what front of World War I were these soldiers of fiction located? The first is Sergeant Grisha. Who is Sergeant Grisha? Mr. Levant.
That's the Russian-German front.
In what war?
World War I,
yes. And you'll find Sergeant Grisha in what book?
The Case of Sergeant Grisha by Zweig, Arnold Zweig.
Very good. How about this one? On what front of World War I was Lieutenant Henry located? Lieutenant Henry, Mr. Levant.
Italian.
Very good. And Sergeant Quirk, Mr. Akira.
He was on the Western Front in the American Army in what price
that's
for?
That's exactly right, and that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Mr. Rogers, for joining our bond tour this evening. In a few seconds, I'll announce next week's guest, and we're triumphantly announced that, owing to the fact that the brains of these gentlemen have been stimulated by their stay in Philadelphia, we have paid out no sets to the Encyclopedia Britannica and no $50 war bonds tonight. Now, next week, in addition to Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran, we announce our old friend, the music critic and composer, Dean Taylor, and Charles Coburn, outstanding stage and screen actor, well remembered for his role in The Devil and Miss Jones, and more recently in George Washington's Slept Here, and soon to appear in The More the Merrier. Remember, send letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speedriggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Let that historic chant remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. So round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw. No wonder that with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-1.